Hello, dear souls, and welcome back to the second half of our discussion. It is Saturday, March 12th, 2011. I'm Zanna Harris.
And I'm Deborah Barclay.
And we're here with Katrina and Suzanne. Let's begin this segment by once again settling in, bringing ourselves back into the present moment. Let's take a few deep breaths and allow the breath to connect us once again, heart to heart, mind to mind, and soul to soul. So we discussed before how the fluctuations that cause the disturbances in our consciousness result from the interplay of the three aspects of mind, right? The manas, the primitive mind, the ahamkara, or the I-self, the ego, and the buddhi, the consciousness, the intellect. It all forms the consciousness. In these next two sutras, we will learn the form these mental modifications take and the ways in which they manifest. So beginning with the ways in which they manifest, Sutra 1.5 tells us how we perceive the fluctuations. It says, vritara panchataya klista aklista.
The movements of consciousness are fivefold. They may be cognizable or non-cognizable, painful or non-painful. Iyengar.
There are five types of mental activity. They may or may not cause suffering. Alistair Shearer.
There are five kinds of mental modifications which are either painful or painless. Satchidananda.
Nice. So this sounds pretty, kind of a little obtuse, doesn't it? It doesn't really seem very clear. What do we mean by painful or non-painful or cognizable or non-cognizable? I specifically want to point out two words. Klista and aklista, pain and pleasure. These two are states of mind as much or more than physical sensations. And it's usually only in close proximity to a painful state that we experience the greatest degrees of pleasure. So when we have a toothache, we're consumed by the pain, the agony of enduring that torture. And then when it's taken care of, it's such a relief, it's such a joy. But a few days later, when it's long over, right, we don't wake up in the morning and go, oh, I have a non-toothache.
If only we could be that grateful.
Gratitude.
Yeah, it's usually just forgotten. It's completely forgotten. And we're swallowed up by the next more pressing disturbance, you know, and distress of our daily lives. So more poignantly, even than that, consider this. How many of us, on hearing of our unfortunate brothers and sisters in Japan yesterday, did not immediately feel grateful to be here rather than there? All of our most urgent crises paled immediately in comparison to their tragedy. So, I mean, everything that we have that seems like so horrible in our lives is nothing compared to what they're experiencing. And suddenly everything here just seems, oh, okay, it's really not that bad. It's really something to consider, how much our state of mind rules the pleasure that we're experiencing, the happiness that we're experiencing in our lives. So,
can you bring that back to the sutras? How?
Well, there's pain hidden in every experience of pleasure, okay? So that's how we see it as pleasurable. That's the standard by which we judge, by which we're able to judge what for us is actually a happy moment. It's because we've had a sad moment before.
The absence of the sad.
The absence of the pain. The absence of the pain, right? Means equates with pleasure. And I've heard it said it's only to the degree that we've experienced pain, to that degree can we experience pleasure.
Interesting.
Yeah. I've heard that said.
It's the yin and the yang.
Right. It's the yin and the yang. It's the yin and the yang. So that's one aspect of this. Another aspect is that, say for instance, there's a huge spread of food laid out before you.
Imagine.
And it's just so beautiful. It smells good and everything tastes good. And it's nice to sit around and have conversation, like at Thanksgiving or something, mm-hmm. right? And we just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. And it's so much fun and it feels so good. And then about 3 hours later, you're sitting back and you have this huge bellyache. And oh my God, I ate way too much. And then maybe even a few weeks later, you look on the scale and you gain 10 pounds as well.
Pain.
So that is pain hidden in pleasure as well. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have perhaps even the analogy of that Iyengar makes of the school child who has to do their homework and has to listen to his parents and is rebellious about it, doesn't want to do it. And it's like the most painful thing in the world at that point. However, later on, getting into the college of his choice, getting the job of his choice, is a pleasure coming from a painful experience. I know that my experience with my little bout there last week, the last thing I wanted to do was get up and get on my mat. That was complete distress. But doing it, forcing myself to get up to move, allowed me to breathe, allowed me to come into conscious contact with my inner self and to get a grip on myself, basically, and brought me out of that painful state into a pleasurable state. So there was pleasure hidden in that pain as well.
Mm.
So it sounds kind of obtuse at first, but when we really think about it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. And then some things are obviously pleasurable that are going to stay pleasurable. A massage, you know, mm-hmm. is good for us and mm-hmm. it feels good. Yeah. And some things are painful that are going to stay painful. We can't put our hand on a hot stove.
Would you say that your practice allowed your inner self to come to the surface? To override the
ego?
Or to come through what the negative, the painful, the so forth, that you didn't get rid of the negative or the painful. I mean, it was still
there.
Mentally, it was still there. But you just kind of, okay, it's there, but I will focus on the inner, the calm, the however you choose to.
My wise mind is what I call it.
Okay.
And even it seems, and the focus has been on pain, but also of sort of pleasure as well. Not letting that. I mean, it goes back to the equanimity of mind. But to me, it's not just about sort of overcoming the painful, but it's also about not allowing oneself to go to this extreme sort of place
good
of
point.
Pleasure,
either.
Or you know,
yeah.
sort of taking thing. If something good happens to you, just sort of going crazy about it, you know,
right.
just it was good and it happened and I appreciate that, but not letting it sort of control or dominate, like the ego. I mean, if you get
right.
some sort of promotion and kind of tempering it as well as the pain.
No, I think that is a very,
very
good
important.
Point because
yeah.
it is absolutely true
yeah.
that you can't go off at either end because
yeah.
that's not real.
Right.
You know.
Well, too much pleasure, too much of any good thing,
yeah.
it's not good.
Right.
I mean, I wish it wasn't that way, because a lot of pleasure can be great, but...
That's right, that's right.
But not really.
Absolutely. Iyengar says that pleasure and pain form two spokes of the wheel of chitta, of consciousness. And for that wheel to stop turning and come into balance, we have to balance out the pleasure and the pain so that we come into that middle ground, that place of just being still and tranquil in the sattvic state, rather than rajasic with pleasure or tamasic with pain. You know, we're in the sattvic state. Sattva, Raja, and Tamas are the three gunas. They're the states of nature.
Okay.
That once they are put into motion, create everything that we know as reality. Once we still all of that, then we come into tranquility, serenity.
Yeah. I love that.
So, yeah, so finding that middle ground, very important. Good point, Katrina. Thank you.
Thanks.
Absolutely. So what we're trying to do basically is we're trying to take, let's see, where am I?
Is that this was real?
Excuse us.
We should go.
So So,
I'll make one. Well, while Zena catches her place,
thank you.
I think we should maybe talk a little bit about how getting into our quiet place. I know that I haven't practiced the pranayamas nearly well enough or long enough or intensely enough to get me peace of mind as often as I would like to have it. But I do know that every moment that you apply towards it, the little closer you get. It's like you don't have to say, well, every day I'm going to spend X amount of hours, because sometimes we can't follow through on that. But if we just constantly kind of turn back to it and be aware that, okay, this is a journey that I'm on, and every little step gets me farther along the path. And that's okay, and to try to do this non-judgmentally, because you know, thinking about the pleasure and the pain, we all want to kind of balance it. We all want to be where we want to be at the moment, and it doesn't happen that way.
It's one step at a time,
and I think we need to be gracious and at peace with ourselves, and know that, and just know we're doing the right thing. We're moving ahead, and you know. It'll be okay.
Self-compassion is really important.
I think that's one of the biggest benefits that yoga has taught me, is being tender with myself.
Exactly.
And accepting of oneself. I was reading something recently, I can't remember where it was, but it was talking about how that's the most poisonous thing that we do to ourselves, is sort of, I mean, because we feel judgment from others, that's just kind of the way life is, but to feel it from yourself is almost the cruelest thing that you can do.
But we're constantly with ourselves.
Right.
So therefore, the chance of being criticized is much, much more prevalent, because, you know, where we are is where, you know, we're there with us.
Right. Odds are.
Yeah. So, you know, to be aware of that, I think is important.
Very true. Very true. Thank you. And that's a very, very good point. Yeah. Absolutely. I know it's very important to have self-control and to you know, maintain a self-monitoring, but not to take it over the top.
I like monitoring better than control.
Yeah, self-monitoring.
Just awareness. It's an awareness.
Self-awareness, right.
And guiding. You know, just these are points of guidance to me. Not, you know, if we live them rotely and
exactly.
by the book, then it basically like defeats the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
there
are going to be moments where I'm gonna take pleasure and sulk in my pain, and those moments are gonna be okay too. But the overall picture is working towards this.
Right,
it's
exactly.
the journey
as a process, as a journey, not a goal.
Right.
Absolutely. So in Iyengar's words, nature causes the five fluctuations to appear in their afflictive or klishta forms. Nature causes the five fluctuations to appear in their painful forms. So everything from the outside
okay.
causes these things Whereas Purusa, or soul, tends to bring them to the Eklesta state.
The good.
The more beneficial. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't say painful or pleasurable here. I would say more...
like the more beneficial.
Yeah, the more detrimental or beneficial.
Yeah.
Okay.
Better than good and bad.
So, for instance, the Eklesta, or detrimental form of memory, is to be stuck in a rut, basically, is to be... replay all the old tapes over and over and over again and not learn anything from them. Whereas the Eklesta form of memory is the form that allows us to include Buddhi in there and take all of the examples from our past and use them to make wiser choices in the future. So, and that's, and Buddhi, so manas, part of the mind that is closer to nature on the outer side of this lens of mind, or this sheath of mind, right, is the part that is doesn't make choices. It's the part that just brings in information.
Right.
Reactive, right? Maybe?
It's reactive.
Yeah.
Exactly, it's reactive. So then the buddhi, the intellectual part of our mind, is closer to that... Anandamaya kosha, or the Vijnanamaya kosha, sorry, the soul, the individual soul. So because it's closer to that, it has that property of discrimination. So when we use more the inner part of our mind to operate from, then we're operating closer to...
From a deeper level.
Yeah, from a deeper level, right. Right. Closer to the soul.
Our true self.
Mm-hmm. So we spoke about the wheel of consciousness. Talked about that. And we have to remember also that the vrittis in their Eklesta and Eklesta manifestations aren't separate, parallel entities, but they feed and support each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, I mean, like we said before, we can't really have pleasure without having...
You can't have one without the other.
You can't have one without the other. So everything underlies everything else. And if the wheel's at rest, the spokes remain steady, and the citta, or the consciousness, becomes free from those fluctuations that the spinning of the wheel causes.
Okay.
Basically. Right. So... yoga says it is through practice and detachment that we learn to avoid ricocheting from one extreme of pleasure and pain to another. Through practice and detachment. And it, the detachment comes back to what you were saying, Katrina, about not going to those, you know, extremes.
Yeah.
So what are the five fluctuations? Sutra 1.6, pramana, viparyaya, vikalpa nidra, smritaya. And I forgot to break down the first one that we just spoke of. But pramana is a valid, experienced, or correct knowledge. And it's also knowledge which is studied, verified, proved, or evidenced. Viparyaya is inverted, perverse, or contrary. That's one type of, that's another type of knowledge. Vikalpa is doubt, indecision, imagination, or fancy. Nidra is sleep or a state of emptiness. And smritaya is memory. So, Katrina?
They are caused by correct knowledge, illusion, delusion, sleep, and memory. Iyengar.
These five are understanding, misunderstanding, imagination, sleep, and memory. Alistair Shearer.
They are right knowledge, misconception, verbal delusion, sleep, and memory. Satchitananda.
Mm-hmm. So So they all agreed on the sleep and memory.
Yeah.
And it's like verbal illusion.
Mm-hmm. I know, which I thought was interesting.
Huh.
Yes. Very specific.
Yeah.
Very specific, yeah.
Hmm.
Well, I liked, it seemed like the third one was the most divergent.
Yes.
The delusion?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And yours said imagination.
Mine says imagination.
Yeah,
sure.
It's really
a little more of a positive spin on it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Deborah, what was yours?
Yeah. Verbal delusion.
Verbal
delusion. Yours
so
is
like
the
lies.
Verbal delusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, like lies, yeah.
What was yours?
A delusion.
And that's, and mine's just
imagination.
Yeah. Huh. Now that's an interesting.
That is
yeah.
very interesting.
I guess the theme in all three that seems consistent is sort of false belief.
Yeah, something false.
Fallacy. Believing in something that's not true.
Right.
A fallacy, that's right. So these are all natural psychological states that occur in everyone. And they're dependent on the brain and the nervous system, and they disappear at death. That's what anger says.
Mm-hmm.
These are psychological states.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. And it's really important that we understand these five modifications so that we can still them. That's the whole purpose. I mean, we might say, okay, well, sleep is sleep. Memory is memory, right? And sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong, right?
Rarely.
So what's the point? So what's the point? So it's the point is that we need to understand that they have endless combinations and permutations that can affect both our quality of life and our actions. So rather than attempting to eradicate them and erase them, I mean, there's no way. Like he says, they disappear at death, right?
Right.
So that's
until then, we're stuck with it.
Yeah.
The only way we can get rid of it. So
we don't really want to get rid of them.
No. Get rid of it. We want to transform the effect they have on us.
And five said they may or may not
That's
cause
right.
suffering. So it's
That's
how
right.
we manage them or deal with them or perceive them or look at them
exactly.
is where the feeling is going to come from, the perception.
That's right. I think it's really important. So, for instance, the combinations that they can take, memory plus sleep.
Dreams.
Is dreams or daydreams.
Yeah.
From sitting there, you know, kind of in a stupor,
right.
thinking about the past.
Right.
Any other thoughts you can come up with? Any other combinations you can come up with?
Well, understanding and misunderstanding. It's a vast area because each of us could read the same line, the same sentence, and all understand it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding could be your misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And you know, your understanding is my misunderstanding. So it's all up to interpretation.
The five men and the elephant.
And also the misconception, you know, assuming something when you don't have the facts.
Exactly.
You know, what someone else is thinking or what might happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of attaching to that.
Or what we've, or the reality we're presented with. Say, it's a pretty extreme example, but I mean, say you're a child that's raised in a very racial household.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, that's all you've known all your life. And you're
that's your reality.
You're told this. This is what these people are all about. You believe it.
Well, there would come memory. Memory and misunderstanding.
Memory and
because
misunderstanding.
It's, or if you have.
Right.
Or memory and understanding, as you used earlier about touching a hot stove. Okay, that hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So now I understand that hurts.
That hurts. Right, exactly.
And so we've learned something.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
So what yoga gives us and what this work gives us is the tools and the knowledge and the wherewithal to actually go out and make sure that, or make as sure as possible that we have the facts at our disposal to make the discriminative choices, to be able to say, okay, this is what is here, and this is, I don't know, I'm not really sure, you know, and I can't put a judgment, I can't say, and to be able to give ourselves the permission to maybe not know.
To not know. And that's okay.
And that's okay. but not to absolutely say this is the way it is.
Without some investigation.
Would you say
it's like layering something with all of our past history, with all of our past misunderstandings, understandings, and so forth, and just putting a title or putting a distinction on something when it might not fit, it might not be right,
it might not
be true, that we need to be more open to being here, looking at just what we're looking at, and getting through all the mental.
And I think also it allows us to open to that deeper self that does have that intuitive knowledge that something is right and something is not right. You know? Maybe, if I say something with conviction, but I'm not really that sure, I have that little twinge.
Yeah, I can't do it. Yeah. I mean, I wish I could in my career path, because that's what so many people do. I mean, it's the there's a lot of sort of acting as though you know when you don't, and that's something I've had to come to terms with, because I find that very difficult to do.
Yeah.
And yet the people who can do it instill a lot of confidence in their clients, you know, that they know what they're doing, when in fact they're saying things and I know that they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's
I can't either.
There's always something deep inside that prods.
And it's a dishonesty. Getting in touch with that deeper inside is getting to truth.
I think we're more connected if we cannot, you know, do that false statement or false, you put that false face forward. I think if we cannot do it, I think we are more connected to who we really are.
Because I think oftentimes people who do that actually identify and attach with their statements to the point where they convince themselves that it's
true.
Exactly.
Yes.
You know,
and then they're going to lose touch.
Right.
Exactly.
Part of themselves.
Yeah.
They're not anchored to
that.
Right.
The checks and balances part of themselves.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I like that. The checks and balances part of ourselves.
Yeah.
I don't think enough people in this world
live with that.
They don't.
Yeah.
I think it's apparent.
Stay in touch. Very, very important. So along with the five classifications of the fluctuations, which are the right knowledge, the wrong knowledge, the delusion, the memory, and the sleep, we also have five qualitative types of intelligence. One, a type of intelligence, is a mudha, which is silly, stupid, or ignorant. So just basic foolishness.
I like the silly.
Yeah.
One is ksipta, which is neglected or distracted. Someone who's just kind of vacant. One is viksipta, which is agitated or scattered. Someone who's just constantly somewhere else. One is ekagra, which is one-pointed or closely attentive.
Too focused.
Maybe it could be. I mean, there's always an extreme of everything. There's an extreme of everything. And one is nirudha, restrained or controlled, which goes back to the nirodha, which is in the second sutra.
Oh right.
Yeah. Vritta-citti nirodha. So restraint and fluctuations.
Right.
Yoga. Vritta-citti nirodha. So these combine, these qualitative types of intelligence combine with the classifications and further convolute things. They further, you know, bring our behaviors into an infinite number of diverse forms.
Reactions, permutations,
absolutely. And again, it's the ability to be aware of when we're being silly, of when we're being distracted, you know, of when we're agitated, of when we're maybe a little too focused in one point, or of when we're actually being restrained, when we're, you know, working with someone's restraint. And that is what this work is going to help us to achieve. Just that awareness.
What's so interesting to me is that each of these qualities can be both positively and negatively spun. Mm-hmm. So, for example, mudha, which can be silly, stupid, or ignorant. Silliness can sometimes be a positive thing. It can be something that can bring joy to an occasion.
Yes.
But it can also, if it's in its ignorant form, it can lead to negative consequences. And then I'm looking at closely attentive. You said maybe being too focused, and that can be sometimes in life we need that. And sometimes in life we need to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And it all seems to me to go back to that all of these can be good or bad qualities, but it's about getting them in balance, in a sense. I don't know.
Yeah, I think exactly.
Yeah.
Like
all of it is about trying to get in balance.
Yeah, totally.
I went to see Don Quixote in the opera.
Oh, how was it?
It was beautiful. It was amazing.
I heard.
Yeah. And that's a good example of this.
Yeah.
He was a fool.
He was fixated.
He was a fool. But he was a saint at the same time. I mean, his one and only thought was for the people, the welfare of the people who were suffering, who were poor and had no food. And he gave all, even though he had nothing himself, he gave away everything he had to these people. And he did everything he did out of love.
Mm-hmm.
So some people called him a fool. And some people saw him as a saint. By the very same action.
Yeah.
By the very same action. It's the spin we put on it, but it's also the intent of the action itself.
I was just going to say that, and when you say during practice, you know, send out an intention or just thinking through each motion or each, and it flows over into day-to-day life. I mean, doing things with intention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what's interesting is it's how, in Don Quixote, I guess it's how the people perceive him, but really what matters is how he perceived himself.
Exactly. Exactly. I think he was happy to go when he, in the final scene, he saw his love in the stars, and he went off to her into her waiting arms in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he was happy to let go, you know. And I cried. Very sad. But it was also it was very poignant. It was happy sad.
Yeah.
But that gave me a really kind of nice idea of what those extremes can look like,
yeah.
Depending on how we choose to perceive them. And again, it's the choice of perception. It's the choice. And this is what this work is giving us, is that ability to stand back and say, okay, this is how this can be perceived, and this is also how this can be perceived.
Yeah.
Now let's check the facts in between, overall, see what we have at our disposal, our memory, from memory, see what we have at our disposal from texts and people who have been there before.
Our understandings. Or maybe things we've misunderstood before, and that we've learned something else
from. Right? Yeah.
Experiences.
And how much of that, too, is where the motivation is for the action?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we had talked about this, you know, let's say you decide you want to help a little old man across the street, and you do that, and a truck comes and hits him. You've killed someone. So was that
you've aided in his demise?
Right. I mean, that's a really simplistic one, but in a sense, you know, your motivation was to help him.
Right.
But the end result was
yeah.
death, but that wasn't really your motivation.
Right.
So where people could see, you know, looking on the outside and say, "Oh, it's all that person's fault. Why did they do that?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the perception of where the motivation was.
Where the intent came from.
Yeah, the intention. Because we don't often know what the outcome will be of our actions.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I think, too, also of the desire for people to feel the need to attach a qualification. Like, why do people need to attach whether Don Quixote is a saint or a fool? He's a man.
Yeah.
And he's a man who's living his life the best way he knows
how. The judgment.
Yeah.
Right.
And
why
I think about that.
Necessary?
that couple that went, the Seattle couple actually, that went sailing into the the pirate territories and ended up getting held hostage and ultimately killed. And I've overheard so many conversations of people saying, well, they're so stupid. Who would sail into those waters? And sure, they may have a point, but can we just observe what happened and just let it sad? And why do we have to attach judgment? Can't we just honor, just reflect? As opposed to, and there's a human desire and need, I think, to categorize and put things in a way that we can make sense of them. And often that translates into judgment in a negative fashion.
Definitely.
And this seems to kind of...
Just to allow things to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
a good point. We do either. Good, bad, this pro, con.
Yeah.
We have to put them in some kind of category.
Yeah.
Call them.
So maybe for the next 2 weeks, let's be aware of these fluctuations of consciousness, that they do exist.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be aware of how they affect maybe some of our decision-making, some of the things, some of the actions we take in our lives, and see if something might not come up that stands out. So these are the wrong perceptions of fanciful or imaginary knowledge, correct knowledge from the core of the being, and maybe even noticing how our sleep patterns affect how we think or act in our daily lives, how past memories or experiences color our perception. Anything that might come up in the next 2 weeks, make note of any significant realizations you have regarding this to bring back and share with us in our next meeting. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah? Okay. And for those of you listening online, please feel free to post your own comments and observations on the podcast website. Let us know if you would like your comments included in part one of our next meeting. So I think this will conclude our discussion for today. And again, I would like to remind us all to keep in mind the concepts we've discussed as we walk through the next couple of weeks. Let's notice our experiences in relation to them and see as well how our practice of yoga asana, pranayama, and or contemplation and meditation might also bring clarity to these subjects. We'll look forward to hearing about each other's observations and experiences in our next meeting.
Remember to check our website and its related links for more information on our future meetings. That's www.wayoftheyogi.com.
For now, walk in peace. The journey to freedom begins once we take the first step. But know that though we may make the journey in the company of one another, it is still an individual path we follow to ultimate unification with the infinite within each of us. Loka Somosta Sukhino Bhavantu. May all beings experience the blessings of eternal happiness. Om Shanti Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste.